This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Why don't you take the bus? Is it because you only see one an hour in your area? Maybe you don't even have a bus route where you live. Why don't we take the bus? Talking about this today because more buses more often is the latest sweetener from the state government in this election year ahead of next week's budget. More bus hours and weekend services. We've heard on Raf's show this morning, we have timetables based on the 80s when shops closed at noon on a Saturday. But now there's going to be more buses, more bus hours, more weekend services, and more services in regional Victoria. What do you think of the government's plan? We will be digging into the detail, and you can call me with your observations or questions. It's almost a truism now that people, maybe not as individuals, but as a population, resist buses. Is that just because their timetables aren't reliable enough? Is this the tipping point with these reforms where more services will make them more attractive for you? Or maybe you love them. Tell me why you love buses. Kevin, you've called from Geelong. What do you think of them?
I catch the bus all the time. I live in the city in Geelong. Mm-hmm. And I don't have a car. I haven't driven a car since 1986. And the reason I bought the house here was because it was reasonably close to the city. But I catch the bus all the time.
And why do you like it? Is it because it's so convenient?
I would say I actually don't like it. It needs to be better. It needs to be far more frequent. And it needs to, you know, it certainly needs to run more often on Saturday and Sunday and public holidays. I don't like it. It should be better, but it's adequate for my purposes. That's what I'd say.
Right. And so that is really the key, isn't it, Kevin? It's about being close and being consistent, I guess, in
correct.
The timetables. Yep.
That's correct.
Kevin, sorry, what were you saying, Kevin?
It could be a lot better and it could get a lot more use if it was more frequent.
Kevin, thank you. I'd love to know if you agree with Kevin, 1300 222 774. Pushpa, you've called from East Burwood. What would you like to say?
Oh, well, I think there will be a lot of communities here would use public transport if there is one. But we used to have the bus running in on Highbury Road between Middleborough Road to Springvale Road, Ventura buses. They stopped in 1980s. So there's bus stops here, but the community is building in this area, but there's no public transport. I've approached the local parliament members, I approached the federal parliament members. They said, oh, it's state government, but then they said, no, it's federal. It's all handballs.
Yeah. So which area is that again, Pushpa?
East Burwood.
East Burwood. So you'd like to see more services there?
That's correct. There is bus stops here, but there's no buses running.
No buses running when you've got bus stops. That's extraordinary and quite the terrible tease. Thank you so much, Pushpa, for joining the conversation. We will keep talking about buses. Yes, you remember, on the buses. Where are we all getting on the buses? That conversation coming up very soon. Also another, what's your go-to small talk? What's your small talk when things are tense or awkward? What tips, for instance, would you have given Charles and Camilla meeting Donald and Melania? I've seen the vision and like everyone, I was straining to hear the chit-chat as they gathered on the steps of the White House. They shook hands, a couple of kisses between the ladies, but they were just too far away from the microphones. We just couldn't hear what they were saying. I think it was a pretty safe bet that the president was talking about the ballroom at some point. But we've been talking about all of the elephants in the room when it comes to this particular meeting, this royal tour of the US. And we were just wondering what would be the small talk that you would recommend, for instance, for the King and the Queen. What is your best tip for small talks in those kind of tense situations, those big situations. I'd love to hear from you. 1300 222 774 is the number to call. To kick you off, here's something from the Chaser archive, Ray Martin showing how it's done.
This week on Small Talk, Australia's most respected interviewer, Ray Martin, goes head-to-head with paleontologist and climate change campaigner, Tim Flannery.
So you got here okay? The traffic was all right?
Yeah, it wasn't too bad.
Can you imagine King Charles or Donald Trump? Oh, did you get here okay? What is your best tip for small talk in big situations, the icebreakers when you're uncomfortable? I do default to the weather. I do. We will get the latest on the royal visit to the US. Plus, we have a new US ambassador to Australia. His name is Dave Bratt. What will he bring to Australia-US relations? We will dig into that. Also today, we acknowledge that it's the 30-year anniversary of the Port Arthur massacre. We won't be going into details about what happened on the day, but it feels important to pause and mark the moment and also to ask you what your reflections are on this day, how you're feeling. Australia's gun laws were, of course, reshaped in its wake. We garnered largely approving international attention, quite proud of it. But there are more guns in Australia now than before 1996. So we will touch on where those laws sit now and what control advocates are calling for next. And we'll also catch up with ABC News legend Judy Tierney, who reported live from the scene about the experience of covering such a defining moment in this country's history. I'd love for you to join that conversation as well. But next, let's get on the buses. Yes, the Victorian government is getting us on the buses, expanding bus hours and weekend services. Almost $100 million chucked in to deliver new and upgraded routes in growing services and suburbs, should I say. Also in regional Victoria, a new route connecting Drysdale and Ocean Grove. So a brand new route there. An additional return trip every day between Castlemaine and Harcourt. And more services on the Bass Coast coach routes as well. What do you think of these reforms? Are they enough to get us all back on the buses? I'm joined now by Jill Risley, who is Deputy CEO of Infrastructure Victoria, for their point of view. Thanks for joining me, Jill.
Hi, Mary. Great to be with you.
What do you think?
Oh, this is a really welcome start, I think. It lines up very nicely with Infrastructure Victoria's recommendations. And I think that the research has been really clear that better buses deliver similar benefits to some of those major road and rail projects. And when buses are faster and frequent and more direct, like your caller, Kevin, from Geelong was suggesting, people catch them.
And that's been the problem, isn't it? We're hearing that the timetables, some of them haven't changed since the 80s. Is that right?
Well, some of them haven't changed since they began.
So how long ago was that?
Well, depending on the route, but certainly in regional Victoria, some of those routes haven't changed at all. So extending the hours and the frequency is a really, really important step.
Is $100 million enough? Have you seen the numbers that tell you that this is enough of a change?
Well, we haven't seen the numbers, so we'll wait for the budget to come out and have a good look. But it's certainly a welcome start. There are a number of things that the government can do after sort of these fares have concluded. And one of the things that we've suggested is also looking at simplifying the ticketing system, but also having off-peak fares so that people are encouraged to catch buses and transport outside peak hours.
John, you've called from Geelong. What do you think?
Hi, I don't use the buses in Melbourne all that frequently. We tend to use train and tram. But it's interesting, when we go to Sydney, my wife and I use the buses up there all the time and they're fantastic.
So why there and not here?
Yeah, I think, look, partly because they're very reliable, they're efficient and they're quick, and the infrastructure's well set up. I just think there's a lot more bus lanes in Sydney, and the interchange between train and bus in Sydney works really well. So, for example, places like Bondi Junction and Wynyard, you can get off a train and onto a bus almost seamlessly, and it works really, really well. And And you don't get stuck in the traffic. There just seems to be more bus lanes and they just work really well up there.
John, thank you so much for that call. That's really interesting, isn't it, Jill? Yes. Intersection of those transport. Is that the detail you'll be looking for when the budget comes out, when the plans come out?
Absolutely. And the network, as your caller just suggested, is really critical. So linking bus services up with train services, but also things like bus rapid transit corridors. So making sure that we can get people from one location to another in a really direct and fast route. We've got some of those examples in Melbourne, but Sydney do that quite well.
We've also got regional Victoria having a little bit of this bonanza themselves, a new route, some more return trips, more services. How big is the need in regional Victoria? Does this go far enough?
The need in regional Victoria is really important. So at the moment, many regional Victorians rely on cars to get around, but unfortunately not everyone has a car. So ensuring that connectivity is really important. There's new suburbs in Shepparton and Wodonga that have no bus services at all. So making sure that regional cities are connected, but also people can get around, get to work, get to services, get to education, that's really, really critical.
You're listening to Jill Risley, who's the Deputy CEO of Infrastructure Victoria, and we are talking about the bus bonanza that the state government has offered today in a pre-state budget sweetener, in an election year sweetener. This on text, Jill. The tickets are too confusing and complicated. I guess this must be caught up as part of the Mikey reforms and the phasing out of Mikey as well. This will help buses potentially?
Well, it's both. What we've recommended that there's a simplification of regional bus fares. Mm-hmm. So we've got, they could be much simpler and much cleaner. And we've suggested that we reduce the number of regional fare zones just so people, you know, it's really easy and simple and clear. But also with the new Mikey ticketing upgrades, there's a real opportunity for the government to do things like off-peak fares and simplify the system even further.
What role does Infrastructure Victoria have in that?
We're the independent advisor to the state government. So we produce a 30-year infrastructure strategy and we update that every 3 to 5 years. So we've tabled in Parliament our strategy in November and that has 46 recommendations, many including buses, which is great to see, including some of the announcements today. So really pleased to see that.
Kevin, you've called in from Box Hill. What do you think?
Oh, good morning. Catch the bus every day, have for about 15 years, sometimes 6 days a week. And from Box Hill, it's really good. But there needs to be like a shuttle service from Box Hill to Shopping Town. It's standing room only there during like a Saturdays and Sundays and public holidays, that sort of stuff. But I think at least that's a really good service. And it finishes at midnight and starts at 0500. So the 903 service is really good.
Yeah.
I'd like to see the 901 bus that goes to Tullamarine stop at the terminals because I catch that 901 bus to Tullamarine all the time.
And it doesn't stop at enough spots as far as you're concerned?
Well, it stops at Tullamarine Airport, but it should stop at the terminals rather than the big red bus that everyone likes to get for $18. You can get there on your Mikey ticket. But you've still got to walk for 5 minutes to get to the terminal.
Kevin, it's really good to hear that you're so well served. I think you seem a little bit lucky in terms of how late those bus times are going. Jill, do you agree, particularly when it comes to Tullamarine?
Yes, I didn't know you could get your Mikey to Tullamarine. So that's,
I didn't know
that's
either. I'd like to know how long it takes.
Yeah, that's right. But I think that the point is consistent. When it's reliable, when it's direct, when it's frequent, people will use the service. And I think that's really important. And making sure that the stops are really well considered. And again, it's linked up to different services, whether that be the airport or trains.
I can imagine from your point of view in Infrastructure Victoria, buses offer a great sort of medium-term way to expand services and to get to more places that suffer from transport inequality. But this on text, Jill, buses are run by different companies and having to buy a ticket on each bus is a pain. What are the challenges there when it comes to coordinating expanding bus networks and to do with the ownership of the buses?
Well, that's part of the reforms that the government's been investing in, making sure it's consistent and making sure that people can use their Mikey across services. So hopefully we'll see some real improvements in that space as well.
This from Celia. I don't take the bus as it has too circuitous a route and are infrequent. We've talked about the frequency, but yes, how much work is being done looking at the routes that they take?
And that's come up quite consistently as one of the challenges, that people don't want the bus to wind through the streets. They want it to be more direct. They want it to be more frequent. Certainly one of the really welcome things with this announcement is the expansion of the bus networks into particularly some of those growth areas that aren't served at the moment by any public transport. And so when we can get people from A to B in a really reliable and frequent fashion, people will use the service. So I think it's really clear.
We're talking about buses, how you would like to see those reforms play out. I'm talking to Jill Risley from Infrastructure Victoria. Jill, this is an interesting one on text. I think we should have smaller half-size electric buses that run every 10 minutes or twice as often. Buses shouldn't stop after 9 p.m. at night. You have to walk home after a visit to the pub. There's a few issues there to unpack, but where are we at with EV buses and this idea of smaller more often?
It's really interesting. Brisbane has rolled out some new buses, which are sort of slightly different configurations, which have been really popular. From my understanding, and it's I'm sure that the team at the Department of Transport can tell you about the electrification of buses, but I think we've been doing a huge amount of work in that space. One of the recommendations from Infrastructure Victoria is that by 2030, 80% of people in our largest cities, so Melbourne, Geelong, Ballarat and Bendigo, live within 800 metres of a public transport service that arrives at least every 20 minutes. So again, making sure that people can rely on buses. And when they do, and as you mentioned before, buses are a great investment. The returns are really high. They cost a lot less than some of the other big road and train infrastructure projects and are quite adaptable. So they're a really good investment.
Jill Risley, thank you for taking us through this, and we should catch up with you when we know all those details and you can give it your mark.
Absolutely. Thanks, Mary.
That's Jill Risley, Deputy CEO of Infrastructure Victoria. John from Mornington says, yes, go to Broadmeadows Station, their 901 bus, 11 minutes to T4 terminal. 901 is frequent too. So a few more people saying that they use their Mikeys to get to the airport. We'll keep that conversation going this hour on the Conversation Hour. And also, remember, I'm asking you about the best small talk you've got, the icebreakers that you employ. We will be talking about that royal tour and also the US ambassador to Australia. We've got a new one. Who is he? What will he bring to the role? But at 24 minutes past 11, we are also remembering Port Arthur, the killings there. Gun control was a huge silver lining to an incredible nightmare. But where are we now with guns after Port Arthur?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Well, among the incredibly painful memories that people are having today on the third decade or anniversary of Port Arthur, amongst all that, we have a national success story that we've told ourselves about gun reform, that we got that right. But at the moment, there are more guns in Australia now than before 1996. So there are a few things at play. There's no national register. Thousands of guns are entering the black market through theft every year. Also, an Australia Institute report last month says there's a hole in our gun laws in the form of the sport shooting category. The report suggested or raises the question about whether or not that category is being exploited. So have we let the system quietly erode? What do we do about it? Rod Campbell is the research director at the Australia Institute and joins me now. Thanks for joining me, Rod.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Mary.
Let's talk about Port Arthur in particular. How significant was it in terms of gun control, what that meant for us in Australia, and how successful it was at the time?
Yeah, it was very successful, and you know, the numbers alone tell the story. At the time of Port Arthur, there were about 3 million guns in Australia. And the Howard government buybacks and other reforms dropped that by more than 500,000 guns. So there was a significant reduction in the number of guns in the community. And as a result, we saw mass shootings decline. I think we didn't have a mass shooting in Australia from that time until recently. So, yeah, it was a big reform and it really did the job.
Indeed, recently, and of course we're talking about the tragedy of Bondi. What that points to potentially is the shock reveals our complacency. Have we been complacent about gun control in Australia?
Yeah, I think we have been complacent. I think, you touched on this, Australians are really proud of the way we responded to Port Arthur. And we're proud of John Howard and his major reforms. But I think, because of that success, we have looked back and thought, oh, gun control was something that Howard got right in the 90s, and we don't really need to think about it again. And unfortunately, that's not the case. We have seen mass shootings and increases in gun violence recently. We've seen increases in gun numbers. There are now over 4 million guns in Australia. I think we have gotten complacent. There are various loopholes, and it's time to really focus on gun control again.
So let's talk about some of them. I think you've explained it as a multitude of factors at play here. But for instance, let's talk about the fact there's no national register yet. What does that indicate to you? And should it still be the case 3 decades on from Port Arthur?
It absolutely should not be the case. And this highlights that complacency that we've been talking about. So there was the 1996 National Firearms Agreement, and part of it was that there'd be a national register. And so that all data about guns would be centrally collected, available to the right people, appropriate data made publicly available. And 30 years on, that doesn't exist. 30 years on, we're still being told that the National Firearms Register might be ready next year, and that's been brought forward post-Bondi. So, yeah, it's important to remember that, in places even like the ACT, they still have a, paper-based gun registry. So, yeah, we're a long way from having the kind of data for law enforcement agencies and researchers that we were promised 30 years ago.
And I mentioned the report that the Australia Institute had last month, talking about the sport shooting licence in particular. What did your research suggest or indicate?
Yeah, so just backing up a bit, this was a really important part of John Howard's reforms and that all the states agreed to. And part of it was that anyone who was going to have a firearms license in Australia needed to have a genuine reason to have that firearms license. So they might be a farmer, they might be a security guard, or they might be somebody who does sports shooting or recreational hunting. Those all counted as genuine reasons. Mm. Just wanting to defend yourself did not count as a genuine reason. So that was a big deal that makes Australia different to the United States. So this is one of the things that keeps us from going down that United States kind of path. But what we've seen in our research, what our research did was compare the number of gun licences in New South Wales that are issued on the basis of sports shooting compared to the Australian Bureau of Statistics figures on how many people participate in sports shooting. So how many people say they're going sports shooting compared to how many actually do it. And what we found was there's about 230,000 gun licences in New South Wales on the basis of sports shooting, but there's only 30,000 people in New South Wales who actively participate every year in those activities.
So you picked New South Wales because presumably they were available data. Have you got any indication that the same holds up, that disparity holds up in other states?
Yeah, we think it does. You're right. We picked New South Wales because it has the best data. Again, we were promised consistent data 30 years ago, still doesn't exist. New South Wales data is really pretty good. And what New South Wales data does is break down the number of licences by genuine reason.
So just to interrupt you, Rod, you're suggesting that it be looked at because of just the numbers on face value. Is that right? You're not, you know, exposing any particular exploitative, you know, you haven't got the evidence of any exploitation.
No, at face value, what we're seeing is that there are 200,000 gun licenses in New South Wales that are, you know, at face value in breach of their requirements. So there are large numbers of guns in the community that are not being used for what authorities have been told they're being used for. And it goes further in some other places where some of the gun lobby groups and gun clubs actually advertise that you can satisfy your genuine reason requirement, and I quote here, from the comfort of your own home, simply by joining them. So just joining a gun lobby group is enough to satisfy your genuine reason. And, you know, I think just at face value, that undermines the intent of the Howard government reforms, that anyone who's getting a gun licence needs a genuine reason to have it.
Mm. You're listening to Rod Campbell, who's Research Director at the Australia Institute. We're talking about a series of reports that the Australia Institute has done on gun reform. And, of course, we're talking about this because today marks the 30th year anniversary of Port Arthur. If you have your reflections of the day, your memories of the day, please do join this conversation. Rod, so what do you believe is the next step? Do you believe there is the political will now? As you say, Bondi did push the conversation along, but what's the next thing that we can do to address the situation?
Absolutely. If you look at polling numbers, the Australian public is entirely behind stronger gun control. You know, consistently, our polling numbers before Bondi were 8 out of 10 people saying they supported stronger gun control, fewer guns in the community. So I think the first step would be acknowledgement of that, and perhaps in the media as well, you know, where there's a tendency to both sides these things of, oh, what does a gun control advocate say? Oh, what does a gun enthusiast say? Whereas there are, you know, support for stronger gun control is almost universal. People who want to see less gun control or allow existing gun control rules to continue to be undermined and not updated, you know, almost nobody wants that. So I think first acknowledging that. But really, the next step is to get on with what was proposed and agreed to after Bondi of having buybacks, having caps on ownership. There's no reason why anybody needs to own 100 guns in Australia, and yet we see in New South Wales, again, the only place the data is available, there are about 100 people who own 100 or more guns. So,
and that certainly will be in the spotlight now after Bondi. So
reducing caps on the numbers of guns that can be owned and reducing the overall number of guns in the community are the next thing that our governments should be aiming for.
Rod Campbell, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Mary.
That's Rod Campbell from the Australia Institute. We are remembering 30 years since Port Arthur killings. A little bit later this hour, we're going to be speaking to ABC veteran news reporter and presenter Judy Tierney. Many of you will remember her, and of course an absolute legendary Tasmanian, about actually reporting on that day. That is a little bit later.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
This week on Small Talk, Australia's most respected interviewer, Ray Martin, goes head-to-head with paleontologist and climate change campaigner, Tim Flannery.
So you got here okay? The traffic was all right?
Yeah, it wasn't too bad.
Plus, Liberal MP Philip Ruddock opens up like never before in a Small Talk exclusive.
Yeah. Have you had much rain up your way?
Oh, a bit?
Noble Hansen, I can't let you go without asking one final question. Are you right to get home? Or
9:30 Monday on ABC One.
Oh, the comedy genius of Ray Martin. I do recommend that you look up that clip from The Chaser. Yes, small talk in big situations. I'd love to know from you, 1300 222 774, as we speculate wildly about what Charles and Camilla was talking to Donald and Melania about on the steps of the White House. Mary, you've called in from how long? What's your go-to?
My go-to is, do you follow the AFL? And then the next question is, what team do you barrack for? And then sometimes it's daggers in my eyes, but
that's
a good way to break the ice.
Mary, that's got technique because it's open. You say, do you follow the AFL? The people who don't, you know, they'll launch in. The people who do, they launch in. That's a terrific one.
It is. It's really great. It saved my neck a fair few times, especially when you're in a group and you feel a bit unsure of yourself. That's the best way to start a conversation.
Yeah, I wonder if the King and the President shared similar thoughts about the AFL or any sport.
I reckon they would have the AFL for sure.
Good on you, Mary. Yes, maybe it was sport. Looking at the, you know, the gestures, I'm pretty sure if it's a safe bet that the President was talking about his ballroom as well. Who do you reckon that the President would go for? Or Charles, maybe it's the Blue Bloods, maybe it's Carlton. 1300 222 774, please join me in your conversation about conversations. What would you recommend that the King and the Queen be talking about? And to have a bit more of a learned, more educated guess, I'm joined by Jared Monshine, who's the Director of Research at the United States Studies Centre. Hi, Jared. What do you think they could have been talking about?
Oh, there's quite a lot of things they could be talking about. They actually have a lot in common, both born in the 1940s, both the children or the sons of wealth and privilege, and they both love classical architecture. So I imagine they might have been looking at some of the architectural sites from the White House.
And it doesn't hurt, does it, Jared, that the President has a fascination with royalty. How much of this is just a gift for UK politics at the moment?
I think the majority of this is for US-UK relations, and basically trying to steady them, given all the tumult between the elected US president and UK prime minister. The fact that Donald Trump and his family have long been fascinated with the UK royal family has really, in many ways, been the Trump card for the UK government dealing with Donald Trump.
I did look at the vision of them approaching. Of course, you know, they're all professionals at this. There's enough indication of warmth and so forth. But it is high stakes, isn't it, for both of the parties here, not just the what's happening in the UK, but also when it comes to the Epstein files. That's another thing, awkwardly, that the King and the President have in common, at least relations with Jeffrey Epstein, when it comes to the King's brother, let alone Donald Trump and his history.
That's right. Yeah, there's plenty of things that they could talk about in terms of being embarrassed by revelations of their personal lives. They both have been in the public eye for many decades as well. They have a lot in common on so many different fronts. But one thing they also probably have in common is not wanting to talk about those embarrassing moments. I don't think Charles or President Trump would want to focus on Epstein or focus on their marriages. I think they'd much rather focus on their shared love of history, mm-hmm. and prestige and the historical ties between the U.S. and the United Kingdom.
Maybe the exact columns that they should be putting on the ballroom. And Jared Monshine from the United States Studies Centre is here to guide us through this royal visit. What do you believe is the sign of success for the UK out of this, Jared? I note that they did not allow live cameras to be showing the meeting between the King and the President in order to avoid a Zelensky-style gaffe. Is it basically, if no news comes out of this tour, it's a good thing for everybody?
I think that's exactly what they're thinking. I don't think they want to really have any breaking news from this. This is really just, from what I can tell, according of President Trump and making sure that he has he's more favorably disposed to the United Kingdom more broadly. I don't think they really want, as you said, live cameras. They don't want any embarrassment. I think in many ways it's very easy for there to be an embarrassment about this. We shouldn't forget about the last times that the U.S. President has dealt with the royal family. You had Michelle Obama famously putting her hand on the queen, which is, I guess, more controversial and not according to royal protocol.
We had our own prime minister who did that as well. So, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. I think there are worse crimes. And then you also had President Trump when he went on a visit to the queen. He apparently walked in front of her, which was perhaps not the most appropriate thing according to royal protocol. So there's a lot of different ways that they want to avoid those sorts of breaches of royal protocol and just focus on the personal relationship between King Charles and President Trump.
And if Charles is anything like his mother, we won't find out what he feels about it until potentially way after his passing as well. It's 18 minutes to 12. We are talking about the royal tour to the US. We're talking about what they could have been talking about. RJ from Druin says, "Hi, Mary. I reckon they're probably chatting about the grandkids, cricket and gridiron." It's not a bad call. I wonder if Donald Trump follows the cricket. Jared Monshine is with me. He's the Director of Research at the United States Studies Center. Another bit of news this morning, Jared, is that we have now, finally, after several months, we have a US ambassador to Australia, a successor to Caroline Kennedy, very different type of person, it seems, and his name is David Bratt. What can you tell us about David Bratt and what he will bring to the role?
David Bratt is a former member of Congress, former Republican, and he became nationally renowned in the United States for taking on the prior Republican holder of the seat, which is a man named Eric Cantor. So Eric Cantor was the House Republican lead and by all accounts expected to become the Speaker of the House if the Republicans retook the Congress, so lower Congress. But what happened was that there was revolt in the Republican primary, and Dave Bratt, a very little known and very little spending economist in Virginia, took on this behemoth fundraiser, Eric Cantor, and he stayed in office for two terms before losing to the eventual governor of Virginia, Abigail Spanberger. So I think in many ways, the most notable thing about him in terms of why Americans know him is that he defeated the Republican establishment. And he really was seen as a Tea Party Republican and has now become more of a MAGA Republican as well, but perhaps less with less vitriol than other members of the MAGA movement, because he very much is a conservative Christian.
Conservative Christian. So what do you think he's going to bring to US-Australia relations then? Will he, in the sort of Trump MAGA mold, be encouraged, and indeed was he chosen to take this role and be, you know, take it, stretch the bounds of diplomacy, as we've seen other US ambassadors to other countries do?
Yeah, I think he is perhaps not as polarizing as other ambassadorial picks, including the U.S. ambassadors in Poland and France. But with that said, he definitely is more of a conservative Christian. And so that might jar with the less religious aspects of Canberra. But on the whole, he is, I think, more conventional. He's not someone that really goes for polarizing, insulting rhetoric as some do in politics these days. I think he'll be a steady pair of hands who will not really rock the boat as much as so many other political appointees are these days.
Do we know when he gets here, Jared?
Well, the thing is, it's a quick correction. He's not actually the ambassador just yet. He has to be voted by the Senate. And so,
do you think that's going to be controversial, that hearing?
No, I don't think so. I don't think a U.S. ambassador to Australia has been controversial in some time. And I don't think he'll be the first by any means. So I think he should be able to get a vote in the Senate. And but in terms of his arrival here, that's still to be determined. I think there's a lot of moving parts, and moving a whole family here is not exactly simple or easy, especially coming from small town Virginia.
We will wait and see. Look at those hearings. They're always been, at the moment anyway, they are sometimes quite interesting and controversial. Jared, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Jared Monshine, Director of Research at the United States Studies Center. We're also wondering what the King and the Queen were talking about with the President. And Nicole, who's a nurse, says she has to make dialogue all the time. Her go-tos in small talk are weather, work for the kids. That's what you work, I guess. And school and sport. Yes, they are the go-tos. But coming up next on the Conversation Hour, we are remembering Port Arthur 30 years on. I'm going to be talking to someone who reported from the scene.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Well, we all have our reflections on Port Arthur, our memories of the time, but what was it like to be reporting from the scene? Judy Tierney was one of the people who did, not just a legend of ABC News, state, national award-winning journalist on radio and TV for many decades, but also a fiercely proud Tasmanian. And she joins me now to share her reflections 3 decades after the killings. Judy Tierney, thank you so much for joining me.
My absolute pleasure, Mary, on such a grim subject. Sometimes you really have to think a couple of times before you really take it on, I think.
Absolutely. What did you remember about how you came to cover the story?
Well, I was working for 7:30 Report and also as the occasional producer for Australian Story. And I was having a luncheon at home for significant women, shall we say, a little soiree, all of whom sort of worked within the area of government and places like that, which eventually they all became involved in this story as well. And I received a call from Sydney saying, get down to Port Arthur now. I called a cab. The cab broke down on the bridge on the way, so it was a little slow getting there. The crew was already there. So I suppose I arrived probably 2 p.m, I'd put it there. We were all corralled about a kilometre outside of Port Arthur, and the people had been, you know, flown in from interstate, and all the local crews were there. So there was quite a collection of journos there at the time, along with the Special Operations Group base and many of the government minders, etc.
And at the time you got there, it was still an active crime scene, is that right?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And it was indeed, he was still shooting at that time. We don't mention his name here. I will very, very rarely mention his name. And if you're down on the peninsula, you do not mention his name. We didn't have any phone calls, but I was fortunate that one of the government minders used one of his newfangled devices that could get through to Hobart and took me right to the top of a hill so I could phone my partner and say, I'm okay. And he just said, keep your head down, Jude. I remember that. But it was very frustrating. Look, we have to get a story back to base.
So how did you?
Well, we had to wait, really. People drove in and got some notes and things from us, and they'd take them back to the studio. And we were getting news out that way because they could drive into that particular area. They couldn't go any further. But we had to stay there because we didn't know what was coming next.
And what did happen next?
Well, first of all, it was early morning when we saw the smoke rising from the guest house. It was a terribly tense time. It was horrific. And then the next morning we went in, and we were all bussed in, and the silence was deafening, absolutely deafening. And you had to really steel yourself to stand there and do a piece to camera and say, you know, how you felt and what you could see and what you'd been able to pick up on the stories that you were hearing. And the cameraman who was with me was obviously very distressed because he had to, looking through a little lens at stuff that will, you know, remain seared on his psyche forever. So it was a very, very difficult time. And, of course, as a journalist, as you would know, Mary, having been, you know, correspondent overseas, etc., there are times when you have to switch off. You have to, or you can't deal with it. So you do switch off and you don't become a sort of automaton. You essentially just cut off and become a journalist and you have to forget your emotions for a while.
When did it hit you, I guess, then? I do know about that compartmentalisation, but did it come back at a certain point, and when was that?
Probably a week after I had a good old weep. I had a good old cry, but up until that point I was okay. I think that I think I sort of held myself, and then it sort of all whelmed up in me, and I became Judy Tierney dealing with something that was pretty traumatic, and I had to let it out. And obviously my partner was in wonderful, wonderful support to me at that time. I came through that fairly swiftly because I knew I had to, and the ABC did run, you know, some sessions, which I really didn't find very, very helpful. There were a couple of things there, because what they did with people, the people who had seen this horror on an autumnal day, beautifully quiet, serene, this has a more profound effect when there's something ghastly like this occurs than if you're in a war zone. This was explained to me by a psychiatrist. Mm. So that the actual effect on an individual having to see and endure something as horrendous and unthinkable as this, it has a far greater imprint on their psyche. And what they did at the time, they corralled everybody and sent down a lot of psychiatrists and psychologists, etc., to, you know, to obviously talk to these poor traumatized individuals, and they kept them overnight. And now that has now been deemed the wrong way to deal with it. There's been a lot of studies done that you don't do that. People need to be in the arms of their family or friends at time like that and not corralled and kept. And when the bus came out the next morning, this is the bit that really chilled me. We were back at our camp, at our little place where we were all waiting, and the bus came through, and there was a neon light in the bus, and it cast a sort of very pale and pasty pall upon the people who were sitting in there. It was like a monk painting almost, you know, like The Scream. It was just terrific. I can never forget this. And one of those trench coat journalists went up and started banging on the door, trying to get in. And that's
trying to get into the bus.
Trying to get into the bus. Let me in, let me in, let me on. And look, honestly, that sickened me. And there was some of that attitude, that bother boy stuff, that really made me feel quite ill. However, the majority of the journos behaved responsibly and caring, and obviously, you know, gave each other suckle while we were there to get through and back to our bases.
Judy, what's it been like in Tasmania in anticipation of this anniversary?
Plus, it's somber. It's somber all the time. There's always in the back of people's minds of what happened here. I ran into a woman the other day who was, in fact, at Port Arthur at the time and suffered badly. And she said to me, "Oh, Judy, all these terrible things going on in the world." She said, "People have forgotten Port Arthur." And I said, "No one will ever forget Port Arthur. Who knows about it or had anything to do with it?" It's a singular thing. You can't let anything else encroach on that particular thing, because, look, we all know that the human condition is unfathomable, and I really subscribe to that saying that scratch a human being and you find a savage. I think you've got to think about these things, but how people are still dealing with it, many of them are not. I mean, they've got this hideous memory. You can't get those images out of your head no matter what you do. They are there forever. They are embedded on the psyche, and you have to learn to live with it. So now it comes to times when now we're looking at capping of guns following the terrible Bondi event.
Mm, indeed.
And this government has said that there'll be no caps on ownership. You know, given what John Howard did at the time, which was fantastic, putting the ban and the buyback of all the of weapons, and people generously took their guns, but many did not. They put them in plastic piping, plumbing piping, and buried them in the ground. So there were still a lot of guns around. Today, I believe there are more guns per capita than any other state in Tasmania, and more guns than before Port Arthur.
Certainly when the Bondi terror attack occurred, that must have caused so many ripples through your community as well.
Well, it does. And the thing is that the government asked for the advice of our police commissioner, Donna Adams, who has the great respect of everybody here, and it's ignored it. She's supporting a cap on guns. But the government is saying there'll be no caps on ownership. They want to concentrate on any illegal trade of weapons. Goodness me.
Judy Tierney, thank you so much for sharing your memories of the day and your insights as well.
Thank you for asking me, Mary. I really have to think a little bit about talking about this to this extent, but thank you. I got through it.
did indeed. Thank you, Judy Tierney, former ABC reporter, of course. It is 3 minutes to 12 now. We're asking you, what was the King and Queen talking with the President about? What can you say? I mean, things are pretty awkward. Rhonda suggests perhaps it was about Bible studies, as Trump is so religious. And this on text, surely the Donald thought he was Charles I and asked about civil wars. And secondly, where does he buy his crowns? Yes, they're very, very good. Thank you so much for joining me in the conversation hour today.